This is Mary Flynn, editor-in-chief of this particular issue of Blackbird, talking with Chris Burnside. We're starting out with a chat with Mr. Burnside rather than a video or an audio. As a dancer, which he is in both Richmond and New York and other places, he has worked both with storytelling and movement and with traditional dance. And this fall, he will be having a retrospective concert of his dance works in Richmond, Virginia. And we're going to try to put these both in a little bit of a context and let you follow them by looking at his work as we post it through the summer. First, why don't we talk a little bit about what you've got coming up this fall in terms of the retrospective concert, and then we'll talk some about the storytelling pieces that you've done with movement. How many pieces will be in the concert? How many of them are you resetting? How many right. are new? Do any of them use language?
The September concerts are going to have 6 different pieces in them. 4 of them are from the recent past and the not-so-recent past. They were created from 95 to 2000. And then the other 2 pieces are going to be brand new, and they will be premieres. It's the first concert of just dance work that I have done since 91. From 91 until the present, I've been focused professionally out and away from VCU with my monologues. So I've had several sort of full-length tours and have gone out and about doing the monologue work. Really important to get out and about. If you're in a home base, like Richmond is my home base, it's an incredible city. I feel like it's a city of artists. I feel like I've been very supported here. But this is my home, and I feel like a new piece that you do in your home, some people can be totally rooting for you 100% and not looking clearly at what the work is. And some people have their expectations about, oh, this doesn't seem like the last piece of yours. It seems really different, and I like the old stuff better. So I love to go out where people don't even know who I am and do something, and they have no reference point for me. I have no history with them. So then the work lives in the moment, which is what performance is. So it's really, really a positive process to leave home, go out, and perform for strangers. And that's what I was doing a lot from 91 until a couple years ago. Produced all different types of experiences for me. And a lot of it has to do with where you perform and who the producer is. One producer will be totally together and have their PR out and knows how to network in the community, and you arrive and there's a full house. And then you just fly with these people. Because if there's a full house and there's more than a couple of people, if you've really done your homework with your piece, somebody in the audience is going to respond to most everything. That somebody will get your skewed viewpoint of the world at that moment in the piece. If there's a smaller audience, then the chances of that happening are fewer. So then you have less perspectives to work with who are responding to you if the audience is small. So then I've performed for all different sizes, for producers who didn't get their PR out and arrive and there are 8 people in the theater, and you've come 1,000 some miles to perform for them. And then you have a journey anyway, and it ends up being generally a positive experience. A lot of times, if there are fewer people in the audience, moi has to work a lot harder. There's less energy coming back toward me from a smaller group.
In these different situations, I know there's to a degree a level of improvisation in the monologues. Does it change?
Yes, I would say that there's a great deal of improvisation at the beginning of the process. But after I have performed something for 2 or 3 years, I feel like I have honed everything down to the exact word, the exact vocabulary that fits in that spot that produces the picture.
All verbally? Do you write it down or develop
it all? Everyone's different. Everyone's different. Fort Head was all written. I just wrote and wrote and wrote and wrote. I had just legal pad after legal pad of all the stories I could remember. Fort Head actually came from the first Gulf War. I could not stand that on CNN the cameras were on the front of the missiles diving into the houses and exploding. That seemed to be something we shouldn't be seeing. At least that was my perspective. And then I started remembering, because I had put many layers between 1969 and now, I started remembering my experience in the Vietnam Army. I didn't go to Vietnam, but I was in there for 2 years.
Were you drafted?
I was drafted.
Would you describe a little bit about how you and Fort Hood sort of interacted in the first place, just so folks will know?
Yeah, so I was drafted in December 6, 1969. 2 weeks later, they came up with a lottery system. I was at Fort Campbell, Kentucky, taking basic training. And they said, oh, they have a lottery system now. And so we all stood around waiting to see what our birthdays were going to be with the first lottery. And my birthday was August 28th, and it was like 361. So I would probably not have gone if I had somehow delayed my induction for 2 weeks. I spent basic training at Fort Campbell, Kentucky, and then was assigned to Fort Hood, Texas, which was in Killeen, Texas. And Fort Hood, Texas was better known as Fort Head, Texas, because of all the drugs that were there. So I basically, it was an artillery fort, and I thought that's where I was. I thought I would be there for a short period of time and then be sent overseas. With all my commercial art background, I was supposed to have been assigned. I later found out that there was a number for your job description when you left basic training. And I think mine was like something like 71Q or something 20 or something. I kept saying, what does this mean? What am I going to do? And they would go, we don't know what that is. So later, they eventually said, who can type? And I raised my hand and got put in the headquarters company. And I found a book and looked up this little MO, your job description. And I was to be a commercial artist for the newspaper, but instead I typed, and because I typed and could type well, I didn't get sent overseas. So I spent my entire military life at Fort Hood, one of the ugliest places I had ever been, and it was not a good fit. It was not a good fit, the sensitive young artist, gay young artist, and the military, the artillery fort. I learned a lot. I think I taught a few lessons along the way as well. The thing that I remembered most when I thought about reviving my experience of looking at CNN during the first Gulf War, I just remembered the process where they trained us in basic training. And they started to initially, from the very moment you got there, to break you down so that you became more and more desensitized to the eventuality of killing somebody. And I noted every step of the way and every change in the rhetoric, and was appalled and frightened. And I realized that they were so good and it was so big that eventually I would be someplace and I would kill somebody. And I did not want to kill somebody. So all that came flooding back that I thought I had to safely put away. Because I would say it was the low point of my life. And I thought that was all long distant past. With CNN, I just started saying, I would just like to share some of this process of how they do get you ready to do something that you inherently don't believe in doing, ethically don't believe in doing. So that's where Fort Head came. And that started off, I wrote down every, because that was a long time ago. That was from 1970 until the piece I made probably in 94. Or 95, so that was like 25 years. So I wrote everything, every story I could remember, and then I just started going to places, and the first place I went was Dick Carline's evening art history class, went over to the Hibbs building and did, I think, maybe 15 minutes, and then I kept going back, and I kept going to different places until it became 20 minutes, and then half an hour. Eventually, it was an hour and 35 minutes. In running time. It was the longest I had ever been on stage as a performer. That in a dance concert, a piece might last maybe half hour at the most, and then you go off and you change your costumes, or you're not in the next piece, or you generally don't dance all evening long in every single piece. I remember, like, at about 35 minutes, I just kept looking when I was on stage the first time I was doing it. I just kept looking for someone with a big hook to come and drag me off, because I was like, this seems way beyond the grace period for one person to be in the spotlight. But I stayed beyond that. That piece was really a powerful experience, and I did it all over. I did it up in the mountains a couple times in Virginia, did it over at JMU, and got some letters from people that were initially horrified at who I was and what I was revealing, and then ended up being affected by it and felt like they had met somebody different. And those kind of responses were what really affected me and made me feel like what I had done was, what I had made was worthwhile.
I saw one of the versions here, and it was very funny as well as very moving, as I recall. There were some things in there that were so quirky that they were not laugh out loud funny, but the, like viewing through a prism where you're getting a side view rather than your usual straight-on view.
Mm-hmm.
But it was a perfectly wonderful evening spent at the theater. It was very theatrical, I guess.
I think humor is survival.
Mm-hmm.
When I knew I was in trouble in the Army was maybe 14 months into my stay in the Army, I stopped laughing, and I did not laugh. I remember just going, I've stopped laughing. Nothing seems funny to me. And I didn't laugh for maybe 18 months. From my depression at where I was and the mistake of the decision of having let myself be drafted. And so yes, to see it all again from a sort of black humor kind of viewpoint was really important. If you can't see the humor and the insanity and everything, then I think it becomes too serious. I think it becomes overwhelming. I think life does, unless you can see just how ridiculous a lot of this is.
When did you first find that doing something like a monologue could be a theatrical experience that would work for you? For somebody who had done mostly traditional modern dance or contemporary dance, I wouldn't say traditional dance in the sense of ballet or even Martha Graham. You were a dancer rather than
right.
a writer or an actor.
Initially, my training, because I actually came to VCU when it was RPI and got a degree in communication arts and design. In the middle of all that in college, I had a cataclysmic religious experience at a dance concert, just decided that's what I was going to do, started training. So from the time I was 20, I was pretty much every day training in dance. Certainly my performing career was all dance. At one point I was in New York. I lived in New York several different times. I auditioned for this woman named Bella Lewitsky in Los Angeles, went out there, danced for her, lived out there for 8 years, toured the United States and Europe, taught at UCLA, eventually had never really liked UCLA, moved back to New York City, and had another performance reincarnation in the early and mid-80s in the downtown performance scene. And initially, I just went to the auditions as a dancer, had never really been comfortable on stage speaking, had tried to sort of veer away from that. I think that's what dancers do. I think dancers generally are not comfortable speaking. So a way to hide that and still be in front of people is, if you're physical, is to dance. So this incarnation from like 81 to 85, I was in the downtown kind of performance art scene, but in the dance side of it. And eventually I auditioned for this guy and might tell you a little bit about that audition and that experience. At one point he decided that he would have each one of us tell we had 30 seconds. It was a strange little piece. It was about human happiness and what we all do to try to stay happy or to regain our happiness. And we had like questionnaires that we put out all over New York and phone booths and restaurants and bathrooms, and people would send them in. They would answer these questions and send these flyers back in. And out of all those answers came sort of the piece. And we each had a suitcase in one scene, and we would stand on top of our suitcase, and we had 30 seconds to tell something that had happened that day to us. I found when we were doing it in New York, it was at the Kitchen, every night, no matter what I said I had done, people laughed. So that was like sort of heady. And eventually we took this piece over to a theater festival, an international theater festival in Brussels. There were performers from all over the world at this place, and one night we had performed our piece. Tim, because it was Tim Miller, was the choreographer, said that there was another American who was performing at midnight, and did we want to go to see him? And the person that we saw that night at midnight was Spalding Gray, and it was entrancing. He had like 15 or 20 years of performances that he had been involved in, and he had just put all the names on a card of the Carol Channing version of Hello, Dolly, the Laurence Olivier version of blah, blah, blah. And it just went on. And then he shuffled the cards and then he just put them in this little box. And then he would take the card out. And then whatever that was, in whatever order that was, that production, he would tell a little anecdote about it. And it was very funny, very human, very life-affirming. So I left Russell's and went, I'm going to go back to New York and I'm going to do something like this. Because besides being terrified to be in front of an audience and speak, one of my jobs in my family, my father's side of the family is incredibly intense. Genetically, I don't know what it's about, but it's very intense. And my father was always upset about something at the supper table. And I found that if I could cut through his intensity and whatever was he was dealing with an anecdote from school, that we could detox the whole situation and we could have a pleasant meal and other people could get a little smidgen of the attention. So that was my role in my family. I would tell the stories that would divert from the intensity. So I came back from Brussels. I decided I was going to tell these stories about this older woman neighbor of mine that I lived in Venice with, in this apartment building right on the beach in Venice. Her name was Opal Kelly, because my friends had always loved these stories. So I made a 40-minute piece, and it wove stories about Opal.
What was one of the stories about Opal? Can you remember any of them?
She was a cantankerous, just really, really, she was in her 80s, and she was a spitfire little lover of life and spoke her mind to whoever would listen. And even to those who didn't listen, she would speak her mind.